My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a brooding genius. And borderline mystic. And a common 6:47 half drunk. I'm glad to be here at the Civic Group, and I appreciate Chauncey inviting me, even though I am a week early. I've said that I'm an alcoholic, and that means to me that alcohol has caused a lot of trouble in my life. I don't know if that's a scientific definition of alcoholism, but it certainly fits me. Thanks, Tim. I won't go into any more than an hour and a half to 2 hours of my early childhood. Suffice it to say that I was a sensitive child. My family used to say he's a touchy little bastard. We were farmers in the Midwest near a place called Sioux City, Iowa, which is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. I don't know if we were poor or not. You know, in 1934, when I was born, we did not have federal guidelines to tell us whether we were poor or not. But I noticed the breeze coming through my clothing a lot, and we demanded money, and I resented that from the first day that I can remember. But we were God-fearing people, and if we had the kind of God we had, we'd be God-fearing people too. The God that I was raised with as a child was a lot like the Ayatollah Khomeini. And, you know, I can distinctly remember being promised that if I didn't stop doing some of the things that I was doing, I was going to be dropped into an everlasting pool of fire that could never be put out. And this is by a loving God, of course. And I've had a little trouble reconciling these two differences to this day. But you know, somehow I got the spear, my hated spear, from the very first day and to the very last day. I think I was in school for something like 19 or 20 years, and I hated every day of it. I had a little problem with authority. And, you know, I somehow got through all the way through the 12 grades of high school, graduating without any distinction at all. 179th out of a class of like 200. And in 1952, right after I got out of high school, I got polio and spent quite a bit of time recovering from that disease. Later on, I got a grant from the state of Iowa Rehabilitation Department to go to college, where I stayed for 3 years before they decided that we had two different purposes. And I was an instant intellectual. I'd been a hillbilly kid up to the point I went to school and to college, and then I became an intellectual right away. And really, we started a hippie. We didn't have hippies. We couldn't afford hippies in those days. So we just walked around dirty and unkempt and unshaven and mumbled imponderable truths to each other. After 3 years of this nonsense, and by the way, I did take a drink. I went to the bars when I got to college, and alcohol gave me relief. Alcohol was a fantastic thing for me because I didn't just get a nice buzz. I got relief from emotional pain from alcohol, and I know today that I was in a lot of emotional pain, and God, I couldn't imagine anybody that didn't drink. But after a couple of years of this giving of Christ, the political science professor said to me, you have a weird sort of linear way of thinking. Perhaps you should study law. And so I took his advice. I went over to Omaha, Nebraska, to a place run by the Jesuit fathers over there called Creighton University. And I enrolled, and I knew that it was a tough school, and that it wouldn't be long before I'd be valedictorian of the class. And then I really shaped up. You know, I'd been a bar drinker in college. I drank in the bars and didn't take care of myself. And I went over to Creighton, and I put on a suit and tie and showed up to class every day and beat the cases and decided the cases. And it was just like, you know, that thing on television they used to call the perfect case. It was very much like that. And the grades came out after 6 weeks, and I didn't get straight A's. I didn't get anything close to straight A's. And so I said, see it, they're trying to turn out these little cookie-cutter corporation lawyers. They don't want independent thinkers here. And so I went to the bar again. In a year and a half, I drank my way out of that school, literally. And I never put that on my resume, but he did say that I had virus pneumonia when I left Creighton. You get virus pneumonia in Omaha, Nebraska by sleeping outdoors like drunk, you know, in the wintertime. And I ended up at the University of South Dakota in a place called Vermilion, South Dakota. I know you've been there. That really is the end of the world. Now, I remember one thing I learned at the University of South Dakota. I learned how to do a wonderful lighter fluid trick, which I always talk about, because I don't want to ever have to do it again. I used to get drunk and get in a bar, and in order to astound the bystanders, I would do this trick, particularly for people who had not seen it before. The idea is to bring a can of lighter fluid to the bar in your pocket and order a shot of dry gin. And when the bartender isn't looking, or the person you're going to spring this on isn't looking, you drink the dry gin and fill the shot glass with lighter fluid, a clear, flammable substance. And when you say, Jesus, this is really strong, you know, it's tastes like kerosene a little bit, and people say, well, it came out of that bottle, yeah. You take a drink of this stuff and light a match and atomize the lighter fluid past the flame as you blow it out, hoping not to inhale before you get. Now, I like to do that trick, and it was a big event in a bar, you know. You can tell there isn't a hell of a lot going on in South Dakota, you know. It's either watch the lighter fluid trick or go down and watch the fireman take a cat off the roof, you know. But I remember doing this in a bar in Sioux City one night, and I've been doing it all evening. And the trick was, you know, the surprise was completely off of it. In fact, people were damn sick and tired of seeing me do it again. That was wrong. And so about 2 a.m., just about closing time, I had long since dispensed with the shot glass and the facade. I was drinking right out of the can now. And a lot of fluid running down my chin and dripping out my elbow. And I lit that match and blew up like a Roman candle. Boom! And back in the hospital, my son, Philip O'Brien, and I were sitting on the edge of this hospital bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're drinking a can of Budweiser, a piece, cold Budweiser. And we're laughing up a storm about how much fun we had that evening. So I'm just reminded of the bandages on my face. I had second-degree burns on my face and hands. I'm glad I'm in AA because I don't know if I could stand much more fun out there. I like that law school. I like to remember. That's all I really learned at South Dakota. But I got out of law school and started practicing in Iowa, and got in and out of chapters a little dab. But practicing in a real estate law firm, examining abstracts of title to real property, was dabber yet, if that's a word. And after a while, I got bored with that, so I got involved in politics. As an Irishman, that's, you know, kind of natural. And so when JFK was elected to the presidency, he appointed his younger brother Robert Kennedy to be Attorney General of the United States. Said that Bobby needed a little experience before he went out into private practice, so he made him Attorney General of the United States. And Robert appointed me to be Assistant U.S. Attorney for my district. I became a federal prosecutor at a very young age, 27 years old. And, you know, it was a good job for a guy who'd never had a decent job in his life. And a guy who had been drunk in the beer bars up until that point. What changed about my life after I went to work for the government was that I began falling off much better bar stools. And I had money to buy more than tap beer. But, you know, by this time my alcoholism, which I believe I had from birth, had really flowered. I know that I was sick all the time. I walked around with a headache and diarrhea all the time. And I didn't know that there was a way to live without doing that. I tried cases in six cities, and I was sick enough to be hospitalized a lot of the time that I was working. And I just thought that's how people were, that were macho, high-drinking guys, you know. And I didn't know that I was suffering from alcoholism. I hadn't the faintest idea about that. But I got kind of a paranoia after a few years, and it was a real paranoia. I believed that they were going to find out about me. And I to this day don't know who they were or what it was they were going to find out, but that kind of alcoholic paranoia will get you moving. So I left the government in 1954, got married, and decided to run for public office at the state level. It was kind of a way to keep the burden down, plus the fact that if you run for office, you get together with a lot of parties. And if you're a bar drinker like me, there's a lot of campaigning done in bars. At least there was in the places where I went. And so I got on the ballot in 1964 to run for the state senate from my district. And I started campaigning in the bars, as God intended. And I took a lot of hands in a lot of bars, and some of them I can even remember. But you know, it wouldn't have made a damn bit of difference, because in 1954, Goldwater and Johnson were running against each other, and as you may recall, some of you, Johnson won by an overwhelming landslide, carrying himself and a lot of other incompetents into office. I was elected that year, and I went to the morning to serve in the Iowa Senate. This is part of my alcohol story. You know, they say that no man's life or property is safe while the legislature is in session. But we went down to Des Moines to make the world safe for something or other. Democrat, probably. And the part of my story that's significant is that I got well acquainted with the governor of the state at the time, who happened to be a guy named Harold Hughes, who was a sober alcoholic. And this is funny, because I remember saying to him at a party, he'd been sober in AA 15 years, I think, and I remember saying to him at a party, Harold, you could have a glass of beer, for Christ's sake. Anybody can have a glass of beer. Little beer never hurt anybody. We just finished classifying beer as a food by state law. And so that it could be sold in the grocery stores. And he said something that I remembered for a long time. He said, yeah, I could have a glass of beer now, but if I drank a glass of beer, I'd want another one, and then I'd want another one, and when I had two or three, I'd drink a quart, and when I finished a quart, I would drink a gallon, and right after I drank a gallon, I'd take this goddamn place apart. He was 6'4", weighed 250 pounds. He was a giant of a guy. And that impressed me. But, you know, because he looked kind of hard-nosed when he did. But what impressed me was that I remembered a long time was the idea that the first one sets up the phenomenon of craving. He didn't use words like phenomenon of craving. Harold Hughes is a truck driver, but he sure taught me about that concept. Anyway, to make it as short a story as I can, I have to get started by 9:15, or they turn on the blue light up here, I guess. I left the legislature after one term and began something that I didn't really want to be, but it looked like a good deal for a drunk. I became a lobbyist, a guy that wines and dines the members of the legislature to influence their vote on legislative issues. And that was a perfect place for a drunk because I really wasn't responsible to anybody, and my sole and exclusive job was the party. And I did it very well. I lobbied the members of the House and Senate, and when they went home and fed off their fears, I lobbied the barmaids and the bartenders. And, it was a good job. I'd be doing it still, except that I started having some mild eccentricities in my personality. I noticed that I was seeing little things out of the corner of my eye a lot, you know. And when you turn real quick, they're gone. They're always gone. I also was listing about 2 degrees to starboard all the time from some kind of alcoholic neuritis. And the local doctors could not tell what the hell was wrong with me. Some of them said, you know, we think you got diabetes, and the other one said, we think you got hypoglycemia, and so on like that. And finally, they sent me to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, where I outsmarted some of the finest doctors in the United States. I paid them $800 to find out what was wrong with me, and the second question they asked me, I lied to them. They said, do you drink a lot? And I said, I have an occasional social drink. And after that, I expected the guy to say, okay, how close together are your occasions, and how much do you drink on each occasion? But they weren't apparently curious about that at the time. They might have picked up on alcoholism today. I would imagine they would. But in those days, they weren't too keen on picking up alcoholic disorders. I went back to Des Moines with a wonderful diagnosis. They had told me, you have executive stress syndrome. That's a damn nice name for what was wrong with me, I think. And the best part of it was, they said, there was no known cure, but you can arrest this problem by taking these little yellow and blue pills. Apparently they believed that alcoholism was a valium deficiency. I remember that taking those blue and yellow pills made me very serene on top of alcohol. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was suicidal, I remember that now. And I was hospitalized for 7 days with uncontrollable shaking, anxiety attacks, they call them. I believe today it was alcoholic withdrawal. But things are going down here. In July of 68, my wife and by this time a little girl and I were traveling on the freeway from Omaha to Des Moines in a station wagon when a lady rear-ended us doing about 85 miles an hour, kicked us off the freeway and rolled us up in a ball 100 yards down the slope. And my wife was killed in that accident, and I was banged up a little bit. My daughter was not injured, but when I got to the hospital, I had a terrible thirst, and I pursued that thirst as best I could for about a month. And your body will not accept any more than a certain amount of alcohol, and mine said, hold it, after about 30 days. And I came to someplace and made one of those classic alcoholic decisions, those quick judgments you're so good at. I decided that all of the trouble that I'd ever had in my life had occurred in Iowa. And the answer is real simple if you think the way I think, and that is get the hell out of Iowa, you know. So it reminds me, I read someplace about the architect Frank Lloyd Wright said that the continent of the United States is tilted slightly to the southwest because everything that is loose rolls out to California eventually. And so I got my elderly mother convinced that it was going to be better in California. And, you know, the fresh air and the sunshine and all that stuff. So we moved up to Ojai, California in 1969. And it was terrific. I remember being in Ojai about 37 minutes before I found the Firebird Tavern. And I spent 3 years in the Firebird Tavern having some of the wares. And it was a bad time. My alcoholism was in full bloom. I had blackouts. I had just done a geographical cure for alcoholism. I had enormous anxiety and fear and everything you can think about that you've had as a practicing alcoholic. I got licensed out here and started practicing in an old frame house down in Ventura. And I started trying criminal cases because that was about the only kind of work that the new kid on the block could do, and make any money at it. So I started defending people accused of crime, people I had met in the bars, to be exact. You know, in the bars I went to, half the people there were on parole, the other half were on probation, and there was some coming and some going, you know. And there was always a few drunk driving cases to be done, and manslaughter cases, and assault with a deadly weapon cases. And so I started getting kind of busy, but I was cross-examining police officers all day and trying to humiliate them as best I could. And that was okay, but I didn't want to meet them on the freeway at night. You know, with a 2-7 gut alcohol. And so I started sleeping in my office. And in the morning, I woke up and see this writing in front of my face, and it said, Louisiana Desk Company. I was sleeping in my office under the desk again. I somehow just crawled in under the desk and go to sleep. And fully clothed, you know, suit and tie. And it was going to hell. I remember not knowing, can you remember ever waking up or coming to, and there's a golden glow in the sky outdoors, and you don't know if it's morning or night? That has plagued me for years. How the hell do you know? It might be 6 a.m., it might be 6 p.m. But I had that happen a lot of times, and I remember never knowing exactly how I had gotten under my desk, wondering where my car was and who or what might be draped over the front fender. And I like to remember those days. They weren't real funny then. One morning I sat off my desk and picked up the Ventura paper. In that paper was a story about the Terra Retreat House in Malibu, which had burned down in 1970, I think. And they were talking about, in this story, about having these spiritual retreats. I was desperate enough that I was willing to try this. And for me to try going to a spiritual retreat was a little bit like one of the hostages from Iran saying, you know, Martha, we ought to go back to Iran and see the Ayatollah again. You know, that's about how it was. And so I tried this place, and the lady said, we have these retreats every weekend, and you could make one even as early as this weekend. But she said the one this weekend is for alcoholics. I said, I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll come anyway. I went down there and didn't see any alcoholics, naturally. They were all members of AA, and they were sober and clean. And, well, I went to a meeting and heard them talking about geographical cure for alcoholism, blackouts, night clothes, sweat, shirts, the whole thing, and they were talking about me. But after the meeting, one of these guys cornered me, and he thought he had a pigeon, I think. But really, what he was telling me was, I think you're going to do some more drinking, he said. I think also that we have screwed it up so we won't enjoy it anymore. And he was right about that. I went back to Ventura and picked up that first drink again and started down the street until I had enough. I got to the point where I knew that I couldn't stay sober, and I knew that I couldn't drink anymore. My body had become sensitized to alcohol to the point where it was literally poisoning me. And I didn't know what to do, so I called a guy in AA, Bud, and told him that I thought I might possibly have a little tiny beginning problem with alcohol. And he suggested that I go to the meetings, and he said, AA meetings, and he said, you could start today at 3 o'clock. They're having a meeting at Norman and Cooper Manor in Oxnard. There aren't too many people around here that remember Norman and Cooper Manor. It was not a fancy dine out place. It was, you know, like not 10 days and 2 quick follow-ups. It was people lived in this place for years at a time, you know. These were terminal type cases. And when I went over there with my Cadillac and my three-piece suit, both of which had over 100,000 miles on them, I was not impressed with this group of recovering alcoholics. These guys were right off near the pier, and the guy, the head leper, had probably left his teeth behind him when he crawled out of the place he'd been living. And the neat part was that he was reading from this big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, if you want what we have, I got out of there because I thought I might get what he had. I went back to Bud and said, Bud, you know, I don't belong with these people. I really don't belong with these people. And he said, they have meetings for big shots in Beverly Hills. So I went right to Beverly Hills to the Rodeo Drive group of Alcoholics Anonymous. They pronounce it Rodeo Drive, I guess, down here. Probably never been to a Rodeo, or a rodeo. Anyway, I started going down here to the meetings, and I didn't think it was a big deal. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. But I noticed the people were very friendly, and they invited me in, they welcomed me, and more importantly, there was a very handsome lady there who was speaking one night. I was 30 minutes sober, and I wasn't sober at all, actually, when I was going to those meetings, because I would drink, and, you know, I never did raise my hand. So I found out you're not sober if you raise your hand. And so we started going out together, and our ad hoc sponsors at the time said it wouldn't be a good idea to get emotionally involved in the first year of your recovery. We did not get emotionally involved. We got married in 87 days. And with one rather painful interruption to that relationship in 1986, for 4 months, we're still married to this day. Not some kind of miracle, I think. But Mary moved up to Ohio, brought her 2 kids, and I had this little daughter, and we jammed those kids together and wafted off into the sunset. Wasn't like that at all. It was kind of a tough place to live. But we went to a lot of meetings, and I started recovering a little bit physically when I wasn't. I had 8 months of tripping around with the program before I finally got sober. And I got sober on March 30th of 1972, just walked out of a bar one day and haven't had a drink since. And it was because the compulsion to drink alcohol was lifted from me. I had nothing to do with it. I went to a lot of meetings. I didn't raise my hand, but I think if you go to enough meetings, the obsession to drink alcohol will leave you, and that's what happened to me. But it was a miserable time. I was real sick. I had a lot of anxiety, and I used to hyperventilate to the point where I'd end up in the emergency room in the hospital. Poor anxiety attacks, and that phenomenon only lasted for 2.5 years after I had my last drink. And so I was real sick from alcoholism. So gradually, things started getting better, and I actually started taking the steps. And what's really important, I think you ought to follow this example. It's a terrific example. I started, because I was a trial lawyer and windy as hell, and I started talking in AA. And I started talking around California and other places, and pretty soon I got to be what I thought was a fairly good journeyman circuit speaker. And I started to polish here and embellish there a little bit, and I developed a persona and a personality that I could hide behind, and you'd never know that I was depressed most of the time. And that, you know, my marriage was not a haven of serenity. And, you know, things were terrible, but I remember, you know, I just thought that's how you live. I had learned that it isn't really important how you feel, it's how you look. And, you know, I've gone to meetings to cheer everybody up. So depressed, I should have been hospitalized, you know. But after 13 years of that, and after 13 years of being my own higher power, that's a trip you want to try. It got really bad. In 1982, I was appointed to the Superior Court in Ventura County, and then in 86, I was assigned to the Juvenile Dependency Court, which is where we deal with abused families, abused children. And that year, I was over-identifying with abused children. It was a hell of a year. I got diagnosed as having coronary artery disease. I got into the dependency court, and my marriage went to hell. I was separated in October. And so I had to start resorting to desperate measures. I actually started reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got into Appendix 2, which I had referred to in passing many times in my shtick. And I read Appendix 2, and I was startled to find out what it talks about. It says something to the effect that we suddenly realized that we had tapped an inner resource, which we presently came to understand as our own conception of a higher power. Words like that, I'm not sure that's how it exactly goes. But, my God, I had never thought of an inner resource being a higher power. See, God to me is out there looking beyond the Milky Way somewhere, you know, hunting for losers like me, and ready with a net to drop us into that everlasting pool of unquenchable fire. And inner resource never occurred to me. So I, in desperation, I went to the chapter to the agnostics. And, you know, if you're raised in the religion I was in, agnosticism was about as bad as communism. And so you didn't want to be an agnostic, so I didn't read that chapter either. But I found some things in that chapter, the agnostics, that have literally changed my life. It says in there words to the effect that we found a great reality in capital letters, deeper in it. Sometimes we have to search fearlessly, but words to the effect that he is always there if we persist. And the one that put me away was often the great reality is obscured by pomp, calamity, and worship of other things. Bingo. obscured by pomp, calamity, and worship of other things. Well, I had worshiped a whole bunch of other things. I had a lot of pomp in my life, and I had a lot of calamity, at least by my definition. And this was big news to me that, you know, as our beloved Chuck D used to say, the higher power hid himself in the last place that an alcoholic would ever look. And that's right in the middle of us. And let me say, and I think it's about time to wind this up, that I feel like someone who has been marching in the desert for 40 years in exactly the wrong direction. You know, 180 degrees off of where you ought to be. And all I can report to you tonight is that, and it ain't no big deal, I have turned around. And I believe, and it's only my opinion, it's worth what you paid for it, that I'm headed in the right direction. It may have taken another 40 years to get back to zero, but it feels a hell of a lot better doing in this direction than it did in the other direction. So I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to invite you on this journey with me, this wonderful journey of sobriety. Thank you very much.